Daddy is very pleased by events in New York. Life has not been good for the ISIS leader, and he is badly in need of some victories. Just recently, it was reported that al-Baghdadi was killed in Syria by a Russian airstrike, but in fact, the brutal terrorist dodged yet another proverbial bullet. However, al-Baghdadi knows his caliphate is shrinking, and that he himself is in grave danger. He is on the run not only from Western coalition forces, but also from Muslim terrorists in Iran. Iraqi government forces recently retook the ISIS stronghold of Mosul, though not before al-Baghdadi ordered the complete destruction of the Grand Mosque in that city, the scene of his long oratory in 2014. In addition, coalition forces are slowly recapturing other towns in northern Syria. It is there, in the area around Raqqa, that the remaining ISIS holdouts are dug in. But while actual territory is being lost, the worldwide threat level brought about by al-Baghdadi's clever use of social media means that ISIS-inspired terror attacks continue to rise. Just today, a suicide bomber in Kabul, Afghanistan, murdered 8 people in the name of ISIS. The psychopathic al-Baghdadi feels only for himself. Since the missile attack targeting him a couple of years ago, he has ignored his personal appearance, gaining about 50 pounds and letting his beard grow unkempt. Al-Baghdadi is under tremendous pressure. He well understands the brutality he has ordered and the consequences of those actions if he is caught. But Allah will surely protect his servant, or so al-Baghdadi believes. A reckoning, however, is coming. Chapter 12. November 20th, 2017, Tehran, Iran. Morning. General Qasem Soleimani is enjoying vengeance. He is in Syria overseeing battlefield strategy, and this morning he writes to Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, confirming a great triumph over ISIS. This is not just a strategic victory. It is payback for a humiliating strike into the heart of Tehran. It is Monday, and the people of Iran start the morning with outstanding news of Iranian forces capturing a significant ISIS stronghold over the weekend. The citadel at Abu Kamal was the last significant town in Syria held by the Islamic State. Not surprisingly, photos of Soleimani commanding troops on the front lines were splashed across Iranian media. The general looks calm, even professorial, wearing a black jacket and a pair of olive drab binoculars as he surveys the action, surrounded by bodyguards in combat uniforms. Tehran is jubilant about his most recent victory. November is perhaps the best time of year in the metropolitan vicinity, one of the most populous in the world at 14 million residents. The Iranian capital is known for its traffic jams and air pollution so thick that respiratory problems are common. There is also a constant earthquake threat due to Tehran's location atop the deepest seismic fault in the Middle East. Until today, there was also another threat, the Islamic State. 5 months ago, 7 ISIS terrorists launched a surprise attack within the Iranian capital. Some of the fighters even infiltrated the Iranian parliament. Others desecrated a lavish mausoleum containing the bodies of great Iranians like the Ayatollah Khomeini, the religious leader who overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979. 17 Iranians were killed and 43 wounded, the first act of ISIS terror on Persian soil. The killings caused such a shock that the city of Paris, so hard hit by ISIS, showed sympathy for the Iranian victims by turning off the lights of the Eiffel Tower for a moment of mourning. Now Qasem Soleimani is extracting revenge. Claiming to be defending Islam, the general writes about the Syrian victory, over 6,000 misled youths blew themselves up in suicide attacks with explosives-laden vehicles near squares, mosques, schools, or even hospitals and public sites for Muslims. Then, amazingly, Soleimani pivots. After placing the blame on ISIS for the conflict, he directs his energy at Iran's greatest enemy, the United States of America. All of these crimes were plotted and carried out by the leaders and organizations tied to the U.S., and this approach is still being pursued and implemented by the current U.S. officials. Footnote: Soleimani pushed the outlandish theory that ISIS had the backing of Israeli and U.S. governments. End footnote. Soleimani continues: As a soldier commissioned by Your Excellency in this battlefield, I declare the end of the dominion of this accursed and malignant tree with the conclusion of the liberation operations, and by pulling down the flag of this U.S. Zionist group and raising the Syrian flag, and on behalf of all the commanders and unknown fighters. Victory comes only from God Almighty the Wise. Your son and soldier, Qasem Soleimani. The revenge Soleimani is celebrating has its origins on June 7, 2017, just another Wednesday in Tehran. The metro is filled with commuters, and the streets are tangled in the usual traffic. The rule of the Revolutionary Guard and Qasem Soleimani is repressive, but has also produced a sense of security. The people of Tehran give no thought to groups like ISIS. This is a mistake. As the Iranian parliament building opens for business, people waiting for paperwork to be processed sit in a small room near the main entrance. The time is 11:09 a.m., and the 290 members of the parliament are just beginning the daily session. Outside, the sun is shining. Suddenly, four ISIS fighters wielding pistols and Kalashnikov automatic weapons burst into the waiting room, waving their guns and yelling in Farsi. People run and dive under chairs as the shooting begins. The terrorists have concealed their guns by wearing women's clothing. On the floors above, employees lock their office doors and barricade themselves inside. Members of parliament hear the gunfire, but are confused by its meaning. At 12:56, one of the terrorists detonates a suicide vest. The other ISIS fighters take hostages and wait, but not for long. By mid-afternoon, they are all dead. Iranian special forces stormed into the parliament building, saved the hostages, and shot down the three remaining ISIS assailants. It was a flawless rescue. 1 hour later, at a large cemetery south of Tehran, two more ISIS terrorists attack the large mausoleum holding the remains of the Ayatollah Khomeini and his family, as well as several other prominent Iranian leaders. A female suicide bomber blows herself up, even as security guards gun down a male terrorist brandishing an AK-47. ISIS immediately claims responsibility for the attacks. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard rounds up suspects. For Qasem Soleimani, it is clear that such an attack did not happen without planning. The terrorists must have been in place for months, surveilling their targets and obtaining weapons. Soleimani is determined to prevent such an incident from ever happening again. Meanwhile, American President Donald J. Trump fans the flames of U.S.-Iran conflict with his personal response to the attacks. We grieve and pray for the innocent victims of the terrorist attacks in Iran and for the Iranian people who are going through such challenging times, Trump says. We underscore that states that sponsor terrorism risk falling victim to the evil they promote. It has been 5 months since ISIS attacked Tehran. And now the endgame is in motion. Operation Fajr 3, Dawn 3, as the assault on Abu Kamal is known, begins on October 23, 2017. Abu Kamal is a city of brown homes and flat roofs on the Euphrates River, located in eastern Syria near the border with Iraq. Elements of the Syrian and Russian military, along with the radical Iranian-backed terrorist group Hezbollah, work together with the Revolutionary Guard as a belligerent attacking force. ISIS took control of the city after a 3-month siege in 2014, and citizens have suffered grievously ever since, enduring the same beatings, rapes, and beheadings as those in other cities occupied by ISIS. So far, more than 1,000 members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard have been killed in this campaign. Yet the results pleased Soleimani a great deal. It was the general who sent Quds forces into Syria to prop up the faltering government of President Bashar al-Assad 2 years ago. Then Soleimani accomplished a diplomatic coup. He convinced Russia to fight against Syrian rebel factions supported by the United States. The fighting for Abu Kamal is slow in the early days of the battle, but it picks up after Soleimani arrives from Iran. As is his style, the general arranges for his picture to be taken at the front. The renowned Iranian Major General Qasem Soleimani has once again shown up on the Syrian battlefield, states an Arab news service. The article includes leaked photos of Soleimani surrounded by enthusiastic Syrian soldiers in camouflage uniforms. This time to help the Syrian Arab Army, SAA, crush the last Islamic State forces. The mere presence of Soleimani bolsters the attack. Even as the pitched fighting goes back and forth, it is clear that his return to the battlefield is an inspiration. The stalled advance on Abu Kamal resumes anew. Meanwhile, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi knows he is losing the battle, but accesses Western social media to place propaganda. Islamic State leader reported in Syrian town, states the Reuters news service on November 10th, completely missing the real story that is taking place. The truth is, even though the terror group is on the defensive, ISIS remains a threat because it has heavy weapons and money, much of it accumulated by selling oil stolen from Iraq. Footnote: the black market sale of ISIS oil begins with trucks leaving ISIS-held refineries in Iraq and Syria, then transporting their cargo into neighboring Turkey. Unrefined crude is bought at $25 per barrel and sold for twice that much. Russia has claimed that Turkey and Israel were key ISIS oil consumers. Those charges are unproven. Once crude oil was transported into Turkey, it was shipped on to Europe and China, indistinguishable from legal gas and oil products produced in nations such as Saudi Arabia. End footnote. However, Soleimani's coalition is far too much for the ISIS terrorists, who are just days away from capitulation. But before that happens, there is one final gruesome display. On November 14th, 4 ISIS terrorists of Chechen descent breached the security perimeter at Syria's Deir ez-Zor airbase. The facility is built in barren desert, with Russian fighter jets shielded from satellite cameras overhead by concealed hangars. It is from this location that Russia launched a raid on an ISIS training base recently, killing 200 men. Speaking Russian with guards at the gate and dressed in Russian uniforms, the ISIS terrorists enter the facility and explode suicide vests. 58 Syrian army soldiers are killed, and several Russian aircraft destroyed. In a video shot before the attack, the 4 ISIS men are shown on camera praying and preparing for their deadly mission. They are fresh-faced teenagers, fair-haired and of European appearance, smiling into the camera, chatting amiably with their comrades. The attackers die needlessly. The murders they commit do not affect the outcome of the battle for Abu Kamal. The city falls less than 1 week later. In the aftermath, al-Baghdadi has vanished. He is still alive and already plotting more murder. 7,000 miles away, U.S. Central Intelligence Agency Director Mike Pompeo is assessing the situation. He is attending the Reagan National Defense Forum at the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. Pompeo has a long history with Qasem Soleimani, dating back to his own days as an army officer in the Gulf War. "I was a soldier," he will say, I'd seen how if one was focused and devoted resources and understood the mission, that you could accomplish an awful lot. And then, as a member of Congress, I just watched the entire Obama administration essentially treat this terror war event in the Middle East as if it was something that we feel bad that we're having to do this. Pompeo's remarks in California are delivered on December 2, 2017. It has been 2 weeks since General Qasem Soleimani defeated ISIS in Syria. Since then, Director Pompeo has made it clear to the general that we will hold him and Iran accountable for any attacks on American interests in Iraq by forces that are under their control. Pompeo tells this to the Defense Forum, which responds with surprise. The admission is bold, a deliberate public attempt to take a stand against Iranian terror. It is well known that the CIA and Director Pompeo now have the authorization to operate independently of the Department of Defense in the war on terror. The director is free to authorize a strike whenever he pleases. The pragmatic Pompeo could very well be of a mind to attack Iran if circumstances demand. He is a former soldier, having graduated first in his class from West Point. Pompeo is well aware of the covert tactics and strategy employed by Soleimani, and is quietly sure the general has planned the murders of U.S. troops. And for this reason, Mike Pompeo will not back down. Pompeo even goes so far as to send Soleimani a letter, which is hand-delivered to him. In the letter, he states that the United States will push back aggressively against any terror committed by Iran. Soleimani replies, "I will not accept your letter, nor will I read it." But the message has been delivered. The United States is definitely at war with General Qasem Soleimani. And also with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. The ISIS leader has disappeared, knowing that Soleimani is closing in. Al-Baghdadi has become so careful about being caught that he often holds strategy talks with his top aides inside a minivan, surrounded by a load of fresh vegetables to remain unseen. But in an act of defiance, al-Baghdadi is making plans to murder the Iranian general. Sunni chasing Shia, Shia chasing Sunni. One monster after another monster. That is not an overstatement. Chapter 13. January 30th, 2018, Washington, D.C., 9:15 p.m. Donald Trump wants to get both monsters. The President of the United States stands before Congress about to give his first State of the Union address since taking office 1 year ago. He wears a dark blue suit and royal blue tie. A small American flag pin is affixed to his left lapel. Vice President Mike Pence and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan sit directly behind Mr. Trump. The room is full. A mixture of senators, representatives, Supreme Court justices, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and a host of invited guests. The weather outside is windy and the temperature below freezing, but it is warm and stuffy inside this massive legislative chamber. Mr. Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, the First Lady of the United States, and my fellow Americans, the President begins. Less than 1 year has passed since I first stood at this podium in this majestic chamber to speak on behalf of the American people and to address their concerns, their hopes, and their dreams. There is much for the President to talk about this evening, from the economy to ending a nuclear arms deal with Iran that the President considers unfairly weighted against America. But while the war on terror will not be mentioned until halfway through Mr. Trump's 81-minute speech, the president's initial actions show his determination to end the ISIS threat. 1 year ago, in Mr. Trump's first speech to a joint session of Congress, he called for the United States to take decisive action to defeat ISIS. He noted that ISIS has engaged in a systematic campaign of persecution and extermination in those territories it enters or controls. If ISIS is left in power, the threat that it poses will only grow. We know it has attempted to develop chemical weapons capability. It continues to radicalize our own citizens, and its attacks against our allies and partners continue to mount. The president also vowed that the development of a new plan to defeat ISIS will commence immediately. In fact, it has already been implemented. In a series of top-secret actions, President Trump authorized the dropping of the largest non-nuclear bomb ever used directly on an ISIS training camp. Footnote: on April 13, 2017, an MC-130 aircraft dropped a GBU-43B Massive Ordnance Air Blast Bomb, MOAB, also known as the Mother of All Bombs, on the Islamic State in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province. The purpose was the destruction of tunnels and caves used for training and weapons storage. End footnote. Also, he has furtively sent U.S. troops into Syria to confront the Islamic State. The aggressive posture has worked. By December 2017, the ISIS caliphate lost 95% of its territory, including its two biggest properties, Mosul, Iraq's second largest city, and the northern Syrian city of Raqqa, its nominal capital. However, the attacks on American targets keep coming. On December 11th, a 27-year-old Bangladeshi native who resided in the U.S. as a citizen was inspired by ISIS to detonate a bomb on a New York subway train during morning rush hour. "Oh, Trump," the terrorist posted to Facebook while riding the A train into Manhattan, "you fail to protect your nation." But the electrical worker's pipe bomb fails to fully detonate due to faulty wiring. Instead, he is burned after injuring a small group of bystanders. The Bangladeshi native is quickly taken into custody and confesses that he had built the bomb to serve ISIS. Akayedullah would also later claim that he attempted the terror attack because he was angry with Donald Trump. Footnote: Akayedullah was convicted on 6 counts of terrorism in November 2018. He is serving a life sentence in federal prison. End footnote. The attack takes place at 7:20 a.m. On the same day, the president demands a new policy to keep potential terrorists out of the United States, calling for an end to what is known as chain migration. This policy grants a path to American citizenship to direct relatives of current citizens. 1 week later, Donald Trump increases pressure on the terrorists by demanding that Congress renew Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Amendments Act of 2008. That law makes it possible for the United States to collect text messages and emails from non-U.S. citizens in foreign countries. The National Security Administration is allowed to do this without a warrant or legal pretext. Trump's extension is quickly passed. "Terrorists who do things like place bombs in civilian hospitals are evil. When possible, we annihilate them. When necessary, we must be able to detain and question them. But we must be clear. Terrorists are not merely criminals. They are unlawful enemy combatants. And when captured overseas, they should be treated like the terrorists they are." Trump's State of the Union remarks bring a loud ovation. Both sides of the aisle stand in applause, terror being a distinctly bipartisan issue. The president continues, "In the past, we have foolishly released hundreds of dangerous terrorists only to meet them again on the battlefield, including the ISIS leader al-Baghdadi." The president concludes, "I am also asking the Congress to ensure that, in the fight against ISIS and al-Qaeda, we continue to have all necessary power to detain terrorists wherever we chase them down." But President Trump does not tell the world what is really happening. He wraps up his speech to polite applause and leaves the building, knowing that death orders have already been issued against Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and General Qasem Soleimani. In private, Trump is adamant that all terror threats be eliminated. All terror threats. Donald Trump's strong posture against terror is not controversial to most Americans, but overseas there is alarm. The United States is now acting unilaterally, something that rarely happened under President Obama. And in their desert habitats, both al-Baghdadi and Soleimani know it. Chapter 14. February 15, 2018, Sakarya, Turkey, day. Ismail al-Athawi does not know he is being watched. The terrorist walks through the crowded bazaar wearing a checkered head covering and three-day facial stubble. He is 55 years old. The ISIS courier and top lieutenant to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi moves easily past the vending stalls in no particular hurry to conduct his shopping. He holds a PhD in Islamic studies from the University of Anbar in his hometown of Ramadi, Iraq, and is one of five men al-Baghdadi trusts. One of al-Athawi's key roles is selecting leaders for the ISIS command and control structure, but he also delivers religious messages to various ISIS factions. Al-Athawi is in charge of issuing a fatwa, religious punishment, for those accused of breaking with their faith. In short, Ismail al-Athawi is personally responsible for stonings, beheadings, and murdering people by throwing them off rooftops. The terrorist fled Iraq with his wife months ago when U.S. and Iraqi forces recaptured Mosul. The couple arrived in Turkey and live in this small town outside Istanbul. Al-Athawi has taken on a new identity, using the name of his brother, but an informant now recognizes him from a photograph. Quickly, Turkish authorities place him under surveillance. What happens next to Ismail al-Athawi is still classified. What we do know is that he is arrested. The Turks keep him in custody for a time, extracting what information they can. The terrorist is then handed over to Iraqi authorities. It is more than likely that al-Athawi was taken to the Iraqi Intelligence and Counterterrorism Office's prison in Kayara, 40 miles south of Mosul, which has a very low release rate. This facility is notorious for torture. Interrogations start with being blindfolded and beaten, then grow more medieval. One method of extracting information is to handcuff wrists behind backs, then use a rope to slowly raise the arms to the ceiling, dislocating the shoulders. As this is taking place, the suspect is whipped on his bare back and the soles of the feet with a metal cable. Iraqi interrogators call this the bazooka. There is also the technique of burning a man's testicles with a hot steel ruler. Often, a combination of the two is utilized, with a man hung in the bazooka position and beaten, while a 1-liter bottle of water is tied to his penis with a thin string, cutting deep into the flesh. It doesn't take long for Ismail al-Athawi to turn. In a word, he becomes an informant. The ISIS terrorist begins telling the Iraqis what they want to know, how he and other ISIS leaders travel freely through Syria and Iraq, including the common method of hiding within a pile of vegetables inside a minivan. He reveals the locations of al-Baghdadi's many secret homes. Curiously, he says that the ISIS chief prefers to hide within a region of Syria controlled by a new rival terror organization called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. That crew is led by a former ISIS leader turned enemy named Abu Muhammad al-Jolani. Al-Baghdadi's hideout is located in a mountainous and poor area far from military patrols. His compound is honeycombed with escape tunnels. In fact, the ISIS leader is behaving in precisely the same manner as Osama bin Laden, sheltering in a walled compound just outside a busy town. The Iraqis soon pass the information along to the CIA, which immediately begins the process of spying on al-Baghdadi using drones and satellites. The information provided by Al-Athawi leads to airstrikes on hidden ISIS compounds and munitions factories in Syria. 36 terrorists are killed. The fact that Al-Athawi is in custody is not known to ISIS, which thinks he is still operating freely. There is absolutely no suspicion that his confession led to the bombings. Athawi gave valuable information which helped the Iraqi multi-security agencies team complete the missing pieces of the puzzle of Baghdadi's movements and places he used to hide, as one Iraqi security official describes the terrorist's confession. One thing is for certain. Al-Baghdadi never suspects his whereabouts have been compromised. But Ismail Al-Athawi is not done providing information, and what he puts forth is horrible. Skulls, bones, blue jeans, ID cards, shoes made in India. All that is left. Ground-penetrating radar shows signs of a mass grave, but it takes Iraqi authorities 9 months to finally begin digging. ISIS has murdered so many innocent citizens that there is a waiting list to excavate these atrocities. At one site, more than 500 rotting corpses are discovered. Here, just outside Mosul, the fatalities number 39. All are Indian citizens, among the 10,000 laborers from the Punjab region who are risking their lives rebuilding Iraq. It was 4 years ago that these Indians were captured and murdered by the Islamic State. This was no kidnapping. Families back home never received a ransom demand. The black-clad ISIS fighters who captured the men on June 11, 2014, were armed with assault rifles and had little interest in extracting money from the families of poor construction workers. The Indian government has provided medicine to ISIS, asking for proof of life in return, but none has been forthcoming. Until today, there was no word of the laborers' fate. Relatives held out hope the captured Indians were being held prisoner. That fate would have been torturous, but even the thought of loved ones in an ISIS jail was better than imagining sons and husbands dead. Now that hope is gone. But one man escaped. His name is Harjit Masih. He was 20 when the ISIS attack took place, a wiry, pensive man with dark black hair. He escaped and made his way back to his home village of Kala Afghana near India's border with Pakistan. His story is simple and brutal. 40 workers are loaded into vehicles and driven into the desert. 10 trucks of ISIS terrorists stand ready as the Indian workers arrive near a small railway beneath a hill. It is almost sunset. The captives are of the Sikh religion. Many begin to cry and promise to convert to Islam if they are spared. They will not be. The laborers are forced to kneel side by side. The staccato thunder of Kalashnikov rifles mows the group down. All but Masih. He is struck in the thigh and plays dead, buried beneath the body of a heavy, older co-worker whose weight almost smothers the young electrician. The firing lasts about 2 minutes. Only when the ISIS combatants leave does Harjit Masih escape. Footnote: this mass execution is almost identical to German SS atrocities in World War II. End footnote. Incredibly, the government of India refused to allow him to tell his story. Some leaders did not believe that ISIS executed so many men. But they did, and there was no burial, no attempt to conceal evidence of the mass execution. Wild dogs and buzzards feasted. 4 years of sand and shifting desert wind eventually covered the mutilated corpses. The excavation shows most bodies in a line, with a few facing in a different direction as if they had tried to run. The hunt for the ISIS killers continues, but the trail is cold. His phone is the key. One of the first items taken from Ismail Al-Athawi when he is captured is his cell phone. With the balding terrorists' help, the Iraqis unlock the device. Systematic interrogation follows, for the phone is a treasure trove of information, names, dates, locations of ISIS meetings and safe houses. Finally, al-Athawi reveals the identities of the ISIS leaders whose names are encoded in the device. The interrogators are stunned. They now have the names of some of the most infamous ISIS killers. Using an app known as Telegram, which is preferred in the terror world because of the ability to encode text messages, the interrogators begin a group chat. The American and Iraqi analysts begin assembling information. None of the terrorists on the chat know they are being played. One of those men is a person of incredible savagery. Athawi gave us details on five men who were meeting Baghdadi inside Syria and the different locations they used, an Iraqi official will reveal. The trap will soon be set. The ordeal of Royal Jordanian Air Force pilot Muath al-Kasesbe shocks the world. In 2014, he is shot down over Raqqa, Syria, and captured by ISIS. Stripped of his flight gear and forced to wear an orange prison jumpsuit, the 26-year-old officer is placed inside a cage. There is no chance of escaping the 5x5 cell and its thick iron bars. Video cameras film al-Kasesbe as ISIS terrorist Saddam al-Jamal sets the cage on fire. The images soon flash around the world as the screaming aviator is burned alive. It is one of the most heinous ISIS murders on record. In the perverse world of terrorism, Saddam al-Jamal quickly becomes a celebrity. He is 36 at the time, a former commander in a rebel Syrian army bent on bringing down the regime of Bashar al-Assad. In 2013, he made a video announcement that he was defecting to ISIS. Al-Jamal quickly became a favorite of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and was selected to rule as emir of the city of Abu Kamal. It is thought that he might one day succeed al-Baghdadi. Al-Jamal is also responsible for the murder of 700 Syrians in 2014 and is fond of executing children as their parents watch. Footnote. In August 2014, ISIS defeated the Shaitat tribe, which had fought to defend their home territory in eastern Syria. Led by Saddam al-Jamal, the terrorists then beheaded, shot, and crucified 700 tribe members over a three-day period. The bodies were left unburied. End footnote. On May 10, 2018, al-Jamal makes a mistake. He responds to a text from Ismail al-Athawi. He does not know the text is a setup. Three other top ISIS leaders also reply to al-Athawi, who suggests they all meet across the border in Iraq at a safe location. Of course, it is the CIA and Iraqi National Intelligence Service that is extending the invitation. A trap is set. As American special forces wait, they see four motorcycles heading toward the designated meeting site. As the cycles roll to a stop, the ISIS leaders are arrested. They are taken into custody and never seen publicly again. Even today, the fates of Ismail al-Athawi and the four others are unknown. American and Iraqi officials are reluctant to disclose this information due to a need to keep intelligence networks that routinely share data from being revealed. Footnote. Besides al-Athawi, they are Saddam al-Jamal, Essam Abdel Kadir al-Zawbai, Omar Shabab al-Karbouli, Mohammed Hussein Hadar al-Qadir. Their fates are classified. However, it is known that in November 2018, Ismail al-Athawi was sentenced to death by hanging in Iraq. May 2019 saw Saddam al-Jamal also sentenced to hang. It is unknown whether or not these sentences have been carried out. However, in the case of al-Jamal, it is widely believed he was turned over to Jordanian authorities, who then executed him for burning Muath al-Kasesbe to death. End footnote. so it is that the ISIS leadership has been severely downgraded. But more than that, the proverbial noose is being tied tight. All that remains is to put one fat neck inside of it. Chapter 15. July 25, 2018, Hamadan, Iran, day. General Qasem Soleimani is also being hunted. But unlike al-Baghdadi, he is not hiding. The general has traveled 3 hours from his simple home in Tehran to deliver today's political address. The Shadow Commander, as he is nicknamed, is normally averse to public speaking. His soft tenor voice does not lend itself to dramatics. Most everything about Soleimani is mysterious, and he prefers it that way. Movies have been written about his life, and pop songs praise his name. Yet the most famous man in Iran is so private that he will not release the name of his wife to the public. The Tehran Times is not sure whether he has 4 children or 5. Footnote: in reality, Soleimani has 3 sons and 2 daughters. His oldest daughter, Nargis, was once a source of concern to the general, having moved to Malaysia and reportedly drifted from the Muslim lifestyle. His youngest daughter, Zainab, married a Hezbollah guerrilla leader in 2020. End footnote. Some say he even has a black belt in karate, but Soleimani will neither confirm nor deny a single fact about his life. Yet now is the time for Soleimani to come out of the shadows. The general and the Ayatollahs who run Iran are involved in a heated controversy with President Donald J. Trump. On May 8th, Mr. Trump ended the Iranian nuclear treaty despite global fears that Iran will accelerate its weapons program. The president has threatened war if it does. Qasem Soleimani has been chosen to deliver Iran's response. His words must be forceful and specific. A male-only crowd packs the auditorium at the Hamadan Air Base. They wear Western-style clothing, and all but a few sit on the floor, legs crossed. Many cover their heads with an arakchin, the traditional Muslim skullcap. They are keen to hear the great general's response to the hated Americans, gaping as if they are in the presence of a great celebrity. General Soleimani steps to the microphone. He wears a green uniform with a beige and black keffiyeh draped over his epaulets. He refers to himself as the smallest soldier, having long ago come to terms with his short stature. He often prays that he be allowed to martyr himself in the name of Islam and Iran. So the general does not fear President Trump, nor the potential deadly outcome of the speech he is about to give, even though it could cost him his life. The general begins calmly. The U.S. president, in response to statements by our president, made some idiotic comments on Twitter. It is beneath the dignity of the president of the great Islamic country of Iran to respond, so I will respond as a soldier of our great nation. Qasem Soleimani invents his own legend of humble origins and commitment to toughness, and it begins with karate. All those years ago. Soleimani wants the world to believe he was once obsessed with the sport. 1978. The workday is over. Along with his cousin Ahmad, he rides his second-hand bicycle through the streets of Kerman to the mosque. He knows religious education is important, but would much prefer they head to the dojo where the art of karate awaits. His small stature is a source of irritation to the young man, and he feels that these workouts elevate him in the eyes of others. The young Qasem is the oldest son and second child of a fruit grower, but his father Hassan has taken out an agricultural loan from the government and gone heavily into debt. So, at age 13, Qasem leaves the family village in Kanat Mulk, where the Soleimanis have lived for 2 centuries. He takes a job at a construction site to help his parents. He has little formal education and soon leaves that job for employment with a local water district, rising to the role of supervisor in a few short months. At night, we couldn't fall asleep with the sadness of thinking that government agents were coming to arrest our fathers. He will write of his desperation to raise the 900 toman, about $100, needed to repay the family debt. Once inside the Kerman Mosque, the young man feels at home. He attends sermons preached by Sayyid Ali Hosseini Khamenei, a radical imam. Soleimani himself is becoming radicalized. The pull of religion and self-mastery learned in the dojo give him enormous inner strength. Iran is now caught up in a religious revolution, pitting the longtime monarchy, led by the Shah, against the exiled Muslim cleric Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini. Footnote: the Ayatollah's life in exile began in 1964. He spent time in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf, followed by Turkey and Paris. Khomeini returned to Iran on February 1, 1979, in a chartered Air France jet. End footnote. Qasem sympathizes with the Ayatollah. His father's debts were brought on by the Shah's monetary policies. Plus, the Shah is supported by the despised United States of America. Qasem Soleimani admires the discipline of the Shia holy men and their patriotic desire to make Iran an unrivaled Middle Eastern power. In 1979, shortly after the Shah flees into exile, Qasem chooses to become a soldier. Life in the Revolutionary Guard suits the young man. He proves himself adept at command. His karate skills and muscular physical appearance are noticed. Soleimani is invited to an elite training camp for deep indoctrination into the new Iran's political, religious, and military policies. He excels, showing his toughness by refusing to take sick leave even after being accidentally shot in the arm by a fellow recruit. His peers are awed at the sight of the injured Qasem firing an AK-47 one-handed. But it is the war with Iraq that is the making of Qasem Soleimani. Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein invades Iran shortly after Soleimani completes his elite training. The date is September 22, 1980. Iraqi fighter jets cross into Iranian airspace in a surprise attack. One day later, ground troops loyal to Saddam sweep over the border. The Iraqi army seems to be everywhere along the 400-mile front, easily overwhelming the defending Iranians. The roots of the war are religious. Iran's revolution has placed the Shia cleric Ayatollah Khomeini on the throne. There is a sizable Shiite population in Iraq. Saddam Hussein, a Sunni Muslim, claims he fears Khomeini will foment religious revolution in Iraq and overthrow his regime. The United States is secretly aligned with Saddam, providing F-14 Tomcat aircraft and the latest technology in tanks and artillery. The fighting is reminiscent of World War I, with trench warfare and poison gas. Qasem is wounded several times but always returns to the front. The Iran-Iraq war instills two key principles into young Soleimani. Iraq must never again be a threat to Iran, and the United States must be destroyed at all costs. Soleimani's karate training has shown him that a smaller opponent can overwhelm and defeat a larger foe through well-directed blows and strategic patience. This is how Qasem Soleimani will eventually wage war against America. 38 years later, General Soleimani is on the warpath again. It has been over a year since Trump became U.S. president, but that man's rhetoric is still that of a casino, of a bar. He talks to the world in the style of a bartender or a casino manager, Soleimani tells his audience. One feels that a gambler is talking. The men laugh, stunned to hear the general speaking so defiantly. Soleimani's face remains impassive, but it is clear he relishes this intended response. The general then speaks directly to the American president. Know this, not a night goes by without us thinking of you. Hereby I am telling you, the gambling Mr. Trump, be aware that we're close to you where you can't even imagine. We are beside you. We are the nation of martyrdom. Come, we are waiting for you. We are the man of this battlefield for you. You know that this war would mean the destruction of all you possess." General Soleimani's words are incendiary, but his tone is measured. "You shouldn't insult the Iranian nation," Soleimani tells Trump, speaking to the most powerful man in the world as if they are equals. "You shouldn't insult our president. You must be careful." Every man in the hall understands the provocation, but the crowd does not seem to fear Soleimani himself, despite rumors about torture in the general's prisons. Those descriptions include reports of pepper-spraying genitals, waterboarding, and the chicken kebab, in which a man's arms and legs are trussed behind his back as he's dangled above the ground on a skewer-like pole. Also, every Iranian knows that a reason can be found to arrest anyone. Amazingly, one lone individual shouts from somewhere in the crowd, interrupting the general. The audience is tense as Soleimani pauses for a moment. His eyes seek out the violator, but he is aware of the cameras filming him and the optics of responding angrily. Instead, the general patiently wags a finger and gently scolds the man into silence. The waiting police stand down. The audience once again gives Soleimani its complete attention. But should anyone in the crowd be arrested for disrespect, it will not be the general who oversees the inevitable prison torture. That duty will fall to Sohrab Soleimani, the general's younger brother, a brutal man whose very name does inspire fear. It is November 29, 1981, and the Soleimani brothers are enduring a rainy night fighting the Iraqis. This is Operation Path to Jerusalem, and Company Commander Soleimani is leading Iranian troops through minefields. Among the soldiers in his battalion are his brother and his cousin Ahmad. The battle goes well at first, the Iraqi forces taken completely by surprise. Ahmad suffers a leg injury and is forced to remain behind as the Soleimani brothers push farther into Iraq. Sohrab is just 17. Qasem left home while his brother was still a young child. But now they are reunited in the Revolutionary Guard, Sohrab learning the rigors of warfare from Qasem. The brothers grow closer by fighting together. Ayatollah Khomeini will one day call Path to Jerusalem a great victory. But for Qasem Soleimani, the battle will almost cost him his life. A shell strikes him hard in the torso, tearing open his chest, leading to a great loss of blood. Qasem is evacuated to one hospital and then another for emergency surgery. He survives, but just barely. It is while he is convalescing that Qasem Soleimani has time to reflect on his career path. He commits his life to Iran and service as a soldier. Returning to the front lines as soon as he is able, Qasem pursues that calling with an even greater passion. He commands the 41st Tharala Division, which fights in several major battles, among them the crucial siege of Basra through January and February 1987. The war ends in deadlock, with more than 100,000 men killed on both sides. A ceasefire ends hostilities in 1988, but tension between the two nations remains high. An actual peace treaty is not signed for two more years. In the mind of Qasem Soleimani, the war continues. Iraq must never threaten Iran again. Soleimani's cousin Ahmad dies in battle in 1984. Qasem weeps at the loss, but rejoices that Ahmad died a martyr, a death for a righteous cause being considered soothing and pleasant. But Sohrab survives the war, never far from his brother's side. Footnote: the Sacred Defense, as Iranians call the Iran-Iraq War, was fought from 1980 to 1988. Photos of Qasem Soleimani during the conflict show a young man in fatigues with no sign of rank. Qasem was revered for his solo reconnaissance missions deep into Iraqi territory, from which he often brought back not just information, but a stolen goat for his men to slaughter and roast. This renown led to his appointment as a brigade commander. Iranian radio nicknamed Soleimani the Goat Thief, marking the first time he gained public notoriety for his military prowess. End footnote. The general's popularity and power rise greatly after the Iran-Iraq War. He becomes the subject of pop songs, with Iranian television documentaries about his life telling the story of how a boy born into an impoverished farm family with little education grew into one of the world's sharpest tactical masterminds. To Middle Eastern Shiites, one CIA analyst writes, he is James Bond, Erwin Rommel, and Lady Gaga rolled into one. A former deputy Iraqi prime minister is more succinct in his description of Soleimani's broad appeal, which spills over the border into his own country. All of the important people in Iraq go to see him. People are mesmerized by him. They see him like an angel. An angel of death. The general's rise to power complete, he once again shows his deep loyalty to family. He hands power to his brother Sohrab by granting him control over the entire Iranian prison system. Soon, Sohrab turns brutal, jailing innocent citizens, allowing guards to torture and beat the arrested, and holding men in prison for years without charges. All this is condoned by Qasem. Foreign journalists and tourists thought to be spies are at the top of the list for incarceration. Rumors leak out of the prisons about torture methods and other acts of brutality, like having prisoners run down a narrow hallway through a gauntlet of guards who beat them with clubs. The situation becomes so bad that Sohrab is investigated by Amnesty International for human rights abuses. But in Iran, that does not matter. As long as General Qasem Soleimani remains in power, so will Sohrab. And so it is that the general's speech comes to a close at the Hamadan Air Base. By threatening the American president, he has greatly enhanced his reputation in the radical Muslim world. But in Washington, D.C., Qasem Soleimani's threatening message is received much differently. He has just signed his own death warrant. President Donald Trump stands in the White House diplomatic reception room. This oval-shaped space on the ground floor is where a visiting head of state is normally received following arrival ceremonies on the South Lawn. But today's diplomacy is not of a welcoming kind. Knowing his actions might lead to conflict, Mr. Trump nonetheless announces he is taking harsh measures against Iran. He is going to blow up the so-called Iran nuclear deal. This is a horrible, one-sided deal that should never have been made, the president tells reporters. It didn't bring calm. It didn't bring peace. It never will. Under President Barack Obama, the United States and its European allies agreed to lift $110 billion in economic sanctions against Iran in exchange for a limitation of uranium enrichment by that country. But verification measures in the arrangement were weak. Mr. Trump has long scorned the deal as a farce. It is well known that Qasem Soleimani and the Revolutionary Guard control Iran's nuclear facilities. The mullahs have continuously sought weapons of mass destruction. President Trump believes the Obama deal assists that ambition. However, others say the end of the treaty is a precursor to war. Minor hostilities have already begun. Under Soleimani's command, Iranian naval vessels consistently harass U.S. merchant vessels and warships in the Persian Gulf. That action is a legitimate threat. Iran possesses the Seersucker anti-ship missile, which is capable of sinking an American destroyer. Donald Trump doesn't want war with Iran. He just wants a new deal, a better deal, one that makes it impossible for the Iranians to build nuclear weapons. The United States soon reimposes tough economic sanctions meant to bring Iran back to the bargaining table. Israel and Saudi Arabia, two nations that would become immediate targets if Iran does develop a nuke, support Trump's action. Predictably, Iran chafes, particularly when the U.S. sanctions prevent it from selling Iranian oil to European countries. In fact, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani issues a threat. Don't play with the lion's tail. America should know that peace with Iran is the mother of all peace, and war with Iran is the mother of all wars. President Trump's Twitter response to Rouhani is sent in capital letters. Never, ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious. General Qasem Soleimani's hatred for America grows ever stronger. He is using the tension to gain even more power. Quietly, Soleimani is making plans to run for the Iranian presidency. He knows that he will have the support of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who has become a friend. But no matter what happens in politics, Soleimani now has complete freedom to do whatever he pleases in the name of his nation. Wasting no time, the general begins to accelerate a terror campaign against America and Israel. In Washington and Jerusalem, the threat from Iran is becoming clear as intelligence reports pinpoint Soleimani as a present danger. The U.S. State Department declares the Quds Force a foreign terrorist organization. With this designation, we are sending a clear signal to Iran's leaders, including Qasem Soleimani and his band of thugs, now Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announces, that the United States is bringing all pressure to bear to stop the regime's outlaw behavior. President Donald Trump does not need any more convincing. To him, the situation has become personal. Very personal. Chapter 16.